Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wait, are you gaming? On a Chromebook?
Yep. It's got a high-res 120Hz display, plus this killer RGB keyboard. And I can access thousands of games anytime, anywhere.
Stop playing.
What?
Get out of here.
Huh?
Yeah, I want you to stop playing and get out of here so I can game on that Chromebook.
Got it.
Discover the ultimate cloud gaming machine, a new kind of Chromebook.
And welcome to a special film sack. No, it's not all that special. We're just doing a discussion episode. Okay, you've heard these a couple times. You heard our horror one here recently, and you're now going to hear our science fiction one. Ooh, everybody just like sat up in their chair and went, "Oh, what? My favorite genre,
science fiction.
Favorite genre." Welcome to the program. Of course, Randy Jordan over there. Hello, Randy.
Hello.
Hello, Brian Ibbett. Hello.
Pew 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 pew.
And then the Brian Dunaway. His hair is also.
I don't know.
Oh, that
he
was
took my pew, pew. He took my pew pew pews away, so I had to do some kind of hummy noise.
You were just like an engine, or
Great
like
Scott.
Oh, there you go.
Beep bop borp. How about that one? You can have that one.
Beep bop borp.
Wait, Great Scott. Who does that? Oh, that's Back to the Future.
Back to the Future.
Christopher Lloyd.
That really counts. You know what?
That's a fiction movie.
I'm glad you brought that up because I think that we should not forget. You know, like when you talk about a genre and we try to do a roundtable about it. You don't want to forget the stuff that's like hybrid. It's like, all right, that is science fiction, but it's also a comedy. It's also a family drama in a weird way.
That's a good point. I was thinking about this a lot. So I worked at Blockbuster, or you might even, I worked at Blockbuster when I was a teenager, right? So I've had this discussion a million times because when you're in Blockbuster, you had the new releases and then you had the genres. And every time a movie would go down from the new release, it had to put to in a genre, and we'd have to figure all that out. And there would always be discussion. It would come down from corporate, but then when corporate would come down, like, this ain't no darn sci-fi movie. And so we would, you know, we put it over, you know, wherever we wanted to. But yeah, so we had that discussion a million times, and I finally just came to the conclusion, sci-fi is whatever you think it is. I usually think of it as space and science fiction, or science-related things that don't include stuff like Mad Max.
Yeah, because right? Like technically, as I was going to say, like Mad Max or like even horror movies could say that they're so far out
elements
there
of sci-fi,
that they are science
Cabin
fiction.
Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like, yeah. Well, that
because it doesn't have to be in space. Doesn't have to have a futuristic element. Could just be about two people inventing a time machine and a parking or a storage locker.
Right, right.
Could be an animated film about a giant made of iron.
That's true. Oh, yes. Yeah, I would call that science fiction.
Sciencey, because the aliens almost always include science fiction, right?
Almost always. Yeah, I'm trying to think of. Well, so like Fire in the Sky, we did here in the last 6 months or something. Mm-hmm. Fire in the Sky is definitely has horror elements and definitely has science fiction elements. So I don't know which genre. I don't know where you put it. See, this is why the internet's great, because you can apply two tags to it. You can say horror, horror, science fiction. Whereas back in the day at your Blockbuster, you didn't put a copy in both aisles. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They were you probably erred on the side of erred on the side of horror for that one. I don't know. Actually, I don't know.
It's interesting that you bring that up. Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't prepared for you to go right to some of the hardest, you know, like some of the. Yeah. Like Fire in the Sky is a lot of little genres all mashed up, and it's really just more like a made for TV drama more than anything. You know what I mean?
I mean, made for TV is not a genre. Like, made for TV is a level of quality. Right. Sure.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I never gave it the prestige in my mind of picking a genre for it.
I would still say it's sci-fi. I mean, it deals with aliens. It deals with that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, it's probably on the more thriller level of sci-fi thriller, which is a tough thing when you think about those poor little employees at Blockbuster back in the day who had to group things. I guess.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no, you don't, like you're saying, Scott, you don't have that disadvantage. You can put something in both the sci-fi section and the horror section of Netflix. Mm-hmm.
You just tag it.
You got multis. Yeah.
A lot of the multi-genre science fiction movies are mysteries also. Mm-hmm. And I remember when our Blockbuster just did away with the mystery section.
Yeah, like, we did do that. Yeah.
Yeah, we're
like, this is bullshit. Nobody's looking at this.
Right, because and also it feels to me like there's a thing in our film history where mystery becomes a part of like almost every movie. Like, screenwriters just start building these big elaborate mysteries into every movie, you know?
Yeah, I don't know.
Clue, you would go Clue. That's a freaking mystery. I mean, everything about it's mystery.
It's also comedy too,
but it's primarily mystery.
See, that's where you and I would fight. I'd say, oh, that belongs in the comedy section. I'd go, sir, I work at
Blockbuster. I've been here for 10 years.
Yeah, wow. I think that's why mystery is such a bad descriptor. Plus, I might like walk in there and say, oh, these are movies they just can't classify. It's a mystery. Yeah. Where does it belong? I don't know. That's why it's a mystery.
Like Murder on the Orient Express. That's true.
That's straight up mystery. That's straight up mystery.
And that is the thing. That's a kind of pure version of that genre that used to exist a lot more. You were always getting those Agatha Christie adaptations. You were getting other stuff like
boys.
And that was a genre. I just think that genre had a falling out, and that's why we kind of quit having it. Like, it just didn't.
Yeah.
It quit being compelling. So, and also, Randy's right. Every movie has more and more mystery elements because there's a lot of, you know. I mean, why do we have spoiler culture at all? It's because people don't want to hear about a thing because it's a damn mystery till you find out. I mean, that's what we do.
Right.
Yeah. There are definitely films now, like newer films that stand. And I realize we're going to talk about a different genre now, but there are definitely newer films that set out to be only a mystery movie, like Knives Out. Right. That's the point. Right. Hateful Eight. It sets out to be a mystery movie. That's really all it is.
Well, you tag it a Western too, but sure. Yeah.
But it's a useful genre for a very small number of movies, is what I'm saying.
Right.
Whereas science fiction is almost too broad. There's almost too many things that, because they touch on futurism or because they touch on the unknown and space and so on, we put it all together in science fiction. And that's kind of one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to ask you all, when you just like you're hit with sci-fi, like what is really at the core of
Star Trek
for you?
Star Trek, you say, is it? Okay, tell us why, Dunaway. Sell us
Star Trek. So Star Trek is all about technology and science, technology, everything. They're moving through and interacting with one another, and we really relate to learning new cultures and learning about ourselves. And we're exploring the universe while learning about ourselves. But that's all encapsulated inside the sci-fi technology and science. Everything is wrapped in there. All that stuff informs us about what we're going to do in this show, or what we can do, what we can't do. So it's encapsulated with science fiction.
Right.
I'm hearing that science fiction is about what humanity hasn't done yet, or you know, might do. It's about the future, right? You're like,
right.
Like there's like, we have technology. A movie about modern technology wouldn't necessarily be sci-fi, but as soon as you jump to, here's technology we don't have yet, or here's a place we haven't been yet, right?
Yeah.
Then it's sci-fi.
because you could easily say that Back to the Future, great example, that could exist. You know, like some mm-hmm. scientist could have created a time machine in a DeLorean. All these things happen without the rest of the world knowing about it. It's all like this little pocket, Mill Valley thing that happens, and the whole rest of the world completely unaware of it because all this this adventure that they go on is kind of self-contained. It's not in the news. It's not on television. It's not, you know, made publicly aware except to these people who know about the DeLorean. So it doesn't necessarily have to be the future, and it doesn't necessarily have to be technology that hasn't been invented yet. It could be technology that the rest of the world just doesn't know about.
Right. It impacts the story, right? Everything that is being told in the story is completely impacted. You cannot stop thinking about the science the whole time, even when you're going, oh no, Marty's falling in love, and he's doing, and you're like, oh, but still you're like, oh, this is going to be complicated. Because science.
Well, so, yeah. Even though they don't adhere to even known science very well in those movies, there's a lot of fantasy going on in your Back to the Futures. Oh, whereas in Star Trek, it's like, hey, we're going to teleport people from the ship to the surface of the planet, which is based on some theoretical ideas that aren't here yet. We can't do it yet. But in this show, we're going to say that we figured it out. We found the last mile of the technology and we did it. We connected the dots. But there's like this, you know, I remember having a book in my late teens, early 20s, somebody gave me for a birthday thing that was a Star Trek, basically it was a Star Trek technical manual.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, it was a different thing. Okay.
No, it's like a bit
called The Science of Star Trek.
It's kind of like that. It's it may have even been, but it was basically a big form coffee table book, and it had, I still have it somewhere. It's basically technical specifications of transporters, of the way the replicators worked on the ship. And they get into this like schematics. I mean, it's insane. It's like total nerd, you know, nerdgasm stuff where it's like, here are the exact circuits used in how the thing on your shirt works when you say I'm on my way or whatever. Like they just went nuts with it. And
it's a flux capacitor.
I love that because what it does is it ties the fiction to a possible reality and a possible future that also happens to be kind of optimistic and exciting and progressive and interesting and, you know, all those things. So I don't know, Star Trek owns that space.
Yeah. I believe this is just a faith statement. I think if you were to walk around and interview people and say, where does science fiction begin for you as a kid? They're going to point at William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy.
Most of us.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool. If you think about it, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, because it's a good beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, it actually began. I'm going to drop some knowledge like I didn't just read it.
Ooh. Yeah.
Please do.
According to Britannica, the term science fiction was popularized, if not invented, in the 1920s by one of the genre's principal advocates, the American publisher Hugo Ernsback.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Good old Hence Hugo Ernsback.
Dictionary defines science fiction as...
Yeah, yeah. Like, it is kind of... That's funny, though. It's a relatively, you know, certainly
modern
in the...
term.
Yeah. The history of humanity, it's a relatively short-term thing we've had. It's not been around forever. I always think, science fiction and fantasy, these concepts or these, I guess, genres have existed since man hath walked the earth, but clearly not, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would, you know, like, you can point at individuals, I think, when you're looking at the history of science fiction, like like people like George Lucas, right, who have like, taken science fiction forward from wherever it was at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
The one that interests me the most is Andrei Tarkovsky. And Andrei Tarkovsky interests me because he made these towering great science fiction films that it wasn't possible that I could have seen them at the time. Right. Right. Like I'd never heard of this guy until well after the fall of the USSR and the. You know, like the
as was intended,
right? But you know what I'm saying? Like, in retrospect, like everything's in retrospect about some of this stuff.
Sure,
and the two movies that everybody talks about, the two Tarkovsky movies that are like the big science fiction steps forward, are Solaris, which is 1972, and Stalker, which is 1979. Like I personally didn't see those movies until 30 years after they were made. You know,
was that 2002 like, Solaris thing a remake? The Clooney one? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah, I had no idea.
The OG though,
that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never saw the OG either, but
didn't know it was.
Just what I saw on video on the YouTubes about the coverage of it. Mm-hmm.
I had no idea. That's cool.
And I think we talked about this a tiny bit when we sat. Event Horizon, the original Solaris has a massive influence on Event Horizon and everything else. And like there is like when you look at the history of sci-fi, there are these like moments, you know what I'm saying? Like, and sometimes they're like years long, right? Like the Christopher Nolan moment in the early 2000s where Christopher Nolan pushes science fiction forward.
Right.
That goes on for a really long time, right? Like, I don't know if Memento is a sci-fi film, but like, you know, like all the way up to...
I would call that thriller.
Yeah, would you put the... we talked about this the other day. Thriller, right? That's what we ended up on.
I would say thriller.
Oppenheimer's is the thriller.
But I would say, and this, you know... I don't feel like superheroes should be a genre, but I feel like superhero films typically fit in sci-fi.
Superhero movies are usually shoehorned into sci-fi because no one wants to go ahead and just say it. Oh my God, look at all of these freaking superhero movies. Let's just make a genre.
Yeah. Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight series technically for me would be sci-fi.
Yeah,
right. even though Batman is the most sci-fi of just about.
He's all tech, baby.
Yeah, he's the tech side of sci-fi. But I would say, you know, if you look at Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's more like the space fiction that we think of sci-fi.
You are eventually going to talk about the movies that are sci-fi
in your sci-fi podcast.
Yeah. My point was when you have people like these individual big deal times like Tarkovsky's movies in the 70s, George Lucas, you know, like Steven Spielberg pushes sci-fi forward, and Christopher Nolan is still doing it in Inception, in Interstellar, you know what I'm saying? And like that's really it means that the genre is not going through a curve where it's like it's a big deal and then it peaks and then it falls off like. I don't know. Westerns is probably a good example of a genre that had a time and past that time.
It was every movie for a while.
Yeah. There was a time, like you think about the glut of superhero movies. That was what was happening in the 60s with Westerns, 60s and 70s. It was just nonstop Westerns. And now you get them here or there, but it's not like it used to be. And I really like them now. I mean, I'm a big fan of modern Westerns. I really don't like the era of Westerns. That was not my jam at all. I wasn't born, obviously, but the enjoyment
Except
I get out
the
of
spaghettis, right?
Yeah.
The
enjoyment I get out of the new stuff. I mean, I like some of the old stuff, but I really like new Westerns. You mentioned Hateful Eight, which you're right is a kind of a murder mystery, but it's also just a really great Western, and one of my favorite modern ones. And I wish there were more of them, but I kind of like that it's less is more now, you know? Just give me one once in a while and it's cool. But science fiction, I don't think is ever going to be under that kind of extinction, that level of extinction.
No, no. I think there's always going to be science fiction because basically it's like most of them are looking towards, at least in part, a hopeful future.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, but most of the other stuff has a definite, you can't say, maybe because you can say, I want to see a dystopian movie, but you can't say, I want to see a happy future movie because that's science fiction.
Okay. All right. You just accidentally brought up a really, really interesting topic here, which is sci-fi grim or is sci-fi bleak or whatever?
It has points of bleak, but I think overall. So
let me give you, I just want to give you a bunch of the top sci-fi movies of all time.
Go.
Because as I was just discussing, they're mostly from like 1968 to 1985, which means there was definitely a peak or a rise.
Sure.
Because we're excited about space, right?
Right.
Yeah, yeah, technology. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, I just want you to tell me what they all have in common. So I'm just looking at a random list of the best ones, right? Number one is 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
Number two is Blade Runner.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Number three is Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Number four is Aliens.
Yeah.
Number five is A New Hope.
Right.
So far, there's a lot of bleak mixed in with your two Star Wars movies.
But exactly. We overcome we overcome the bleak, right? None of those.
That's kind of the
definitive, right?
Right. And it's kind of in some of those cases, not the Star Wars cases, but it's technology gone wrong. Like it's the science fiction trope of we've extended too far without we've run before we could walk with technology. Right. And now the technology has gone awry or taken over or is putting nails through their hands and killing people.
Yeah. And I would argue that Blade Runner never has a happy resolution. It has a better than
for the humans.
One of the movies
don't care.
Well, one of
the versions released.
Yeah, one of the cuts does. That freaking drive off in the sunset bullshit. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Terminator, if you take Terminator as an example, Terminator is basically a serial killer run amok that you can't stop. And in the end, you have to finally stop him. If that had been that movie, nobody would talk about Terminator and its influence. They would just say, oh, that's that movie about a serial killer trying to kill everybody. Right. But instead, we got a robot. And because he's a robot, and because it's got this like machines run amok future come back in the past tale, we'd look at it as a tent pole of the genre in science fiction. But really all you did was just swap a serial killer for mega robot. Really?
This list has Terminator at number 21 of all time and Terminator 2 at number 16 of all time. Oh, yeah. And it feels really right to me, but what you're talking about is how these movies often are, they get all caught up on exciting action, and they should. That's a good thing.
It's part of it.
But they kind of like forget to make you smile. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Mm-hmm. Like it's and it's fine. I'm not, you know, it's not a complaint. But like,
I mean, I smiled when Arnold hung up the phone and said, "Your parents are dead." I mean, I I cackled.
Yeah, there are moments like that. But Terminator 2's actually got some decent humor in it. But you're not wrong. They're often very grim, right? They don't. I'm trying to think in like Aliens or Alien or any of the Alien series. There are moments of levity, but it's usually at the expense of somebody, right?
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, that's why Star Trek is like this different thing. Almost shocking it exists still and grows because it's a little
Roddenberry, you know, man.
It's like too optimistic in a weird way.
And they try to bleak it up, you know, occasionally. Discovery.
I love that Discovery term. I love that term, Brian. That's a great term.
It took them a real long time to get there. Well, you know, Roddenberry was famous for not allowing, he didn't want conflict between his characters. And so that really made it difficult for writers because conflict is part of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he wanted the conflict to be the weird planet they found. Or if there was conflict between characters, it's because Kirk was under the influence of some weird nebula and now he had to fight with Spock over it, or they made them play that weird midget chess thing. Sorry, small person chess thing. or whatever, right? But like, even like I remember Deep Space Nine, I'm very fond of. Like, I really like it. I like that show. Yeah. But I will admit, Deep Space Nine pushes the edge of optimistic Star Trek a little hard compared to the rest of Star Trek-dom. And I think also Discovery does. And I think that's why Discovery, A, didn't last as long as it could have, and B, didn't have the impact that other more positive stuff has. I think Strange New Worlds is a reminder that, like, oh, yeah, right. This is the Star Trek we all signed up for, where everybody is kind of working together. We have our problems. We have our trips, but we make up for it, blah, blah, blah. Whereas Discovery was just kind of like, everything's kind of shitty. We're all shitty. Yeah, everyone's shitty. You know,
we want one Barclay. We don't want a whole ship full of Barclays.
That's true. That would be a night. What a nightmare! You
God,
just
God, he's annoying me so bad.
What Discovery could be, right? It feels sometimes it feels like, oh man, you've got 99.9% of this enterprise is just working together. These are people who are the best at what they do, and they've graduated the academy, and then you've got Barclay. Yeah. But then you go to Discovery, and you've got basically, you know, a whole ship
full
of Barclays.
How did we kill Barclay? Didn't we blow his head up? What was that? No.
He didn't die. He's good. He lived. He was in the movies and stuff too. Yeah. Barclay.
Did he ever make it into Picard? I mean, I've seen the entirety of Picard. And I can't remember if we see Barclay.
Yes.
We do. Okay.
Yes, he's still around.
Okay. I need to still finish that last up that season. I've been savoring it because I know it's never going to happen again. So I'm just sort of taking it slow.
I think we're kind of dancing around an interesting part of this topic, which is how the reality that we live in at the time influences the movies that we make and that we see. Mm-hmm. Like when you brought up Deep Space Nine, I couldn't help thinking, gosh, Deep Space Nine really feels like it's made in the 1990s. And I don't mean how it looks, but I mean like those scripts were written by people who had been watching the real world ever since the end of the Vietnam War, and watching how the government was working and how, you know, global politics was working. And so it doesn't surprise me that Deep Space Nine is full of some like post Reagan takes on things like the CIA and so on.
Yeah.
And like nowadays, like there's such a drive for hopefulness in our current entertainment, right? Like, it's not surprising to me that everybody went and saw Ted Lasso the first season and loved it and turned around and started clamoring for Strange New Worlds to have some hope, you know?
Yeah.
Or Lower Decks is the better example.
I hate doing this because I know everyone's gonna make fun of me, but I just realized I can answer this question now. When somebody says to me, Scott, why do you like not just enjoy or go back to or whatever, why do you like Fury Road so much? And I have an answer. The answer is, it is hopeful.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't seem like it on the surface. It seems like a nightmare. Mm-hmm. Everything there sucks. There's nothing good about the place these people exist. But in that place, that whole point is hopefulness. It's like, we are going to find a way out of here. We're going to survive this and get away from what is bad and reset this world, like all that stuff. That's what does it for me. So in a weird way,
I love a world reset story.
See, I do too.
I'm with you on that.
I do too.
Love
so that. When I see something like Deep Space Nine, I remember my first impression of Deep Space Nine was not a good one, because I remember going, wait a minute, what's this gold press Latinum bullshit? We're not supposed to have money in the future. I thought everything was all cleared up. And then I realized, it's complicated. You got it's a big galaxy out there and everybody's dick and you got to deal with it. And I came around to really liking it, but because again, they were finding their Star Trek finds a way to find the hope within that mess and perseveres. But, I don't know. I think this is just built into us. Like, this is almost an all genre thing. We have to have the conflict to have the hopefulness. 'Cause without the conflict, what do you have? You just have boring.
Yes. I'm not making the case that science fiction is always bound up with the current politic. I really want to make that clear.
Oh,
I do believe
Gene Roddenberry was just really good at that. And he's a genre definer, right?
Well, and others, right? So
Paul
Verhoeven only makes science fiction that's about the current thing that has been bothering him.
Mm-hmm. And that's what most writers do. That's what you're trying to do.
I'm not saying all. Don't feel like Ridley Scott really gives a shit what's going on in the real world.
In the current climate, right? With the stuff
What kind of story you're telling?
Yeah, he loves like ancient climate, and you know, he wants to explore like historical stuff. But I never feel like I see a Ridley Scott movie and go, "Oh, what a piece of coverage for our day!" Like, I never feel like
you know what I think.
No, but to see a visionary, because he imagines like, okay, well, we're gonna have, you know, AI soon, and AI is going to have the potential of going out of control. And so there might be these replicants who are self-aware and kind of.
Did you hear Cameron say that? He said, I tried to tell you people back in 84.
Yeah, that was great.
And I was like, oh, shut
did
up.
Really? Made me laugh. Oh, awesome. Like, oh, he did say that recently. I think he was mostly joking. But like, so to the Ridley Scott point, I think that that's somewhat true. But I think more he just approached the Philip K. Dick story and said, ooh, cool movie, and made it.
That's right.
Oh, right. Of course. Yeah, since it's based on.
I think it's important. I think, and I kind of get frustrated with people who get frustrated, but I understand. Like, when you see modern day issues that are getting, you used to not be like this. Every day, all of us on the internet, not everybody in the world, but everybody who's on the internet engaged constantly is getting just overloaded with, you know, voices, people, people saying they're having problems. And other people saying, no, you don't. And just, you know, just all these pieces on the board. And that's really important for us to express those as artists and people who are creating movies and telling stories. So we can address those things in a story. So we can kind of put ourselves outside of what's going on and look at it objectively, like, you know, the kiss in Star Trek when Kirk kisses Uhura. So that's like, we were able to kind of distance ourselves. It's like, oh, it's okay that they're kissing because this is the future and we know kind of where things are going and it's fine.
Yeah. It's kind of like a playground, like an area where you can kind of try these experiments and say, what would happen if ..
Right.
How would people react if this happened and that sort of thing. And
Yeah, which
sandbox.
I guess
that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, there you go. It's a, you're absolutely right. And it's also a sandbox where, unlike, say, just a drama or like a relationship movie or something, where it's also a sandbox for this relationship and exploring that, this is distinct because it's like, here's a thing that's literally not possible right now. It may one day be, but even if it's fantastical, like something like, you know, go back to Guardians, it's still a place where you can play with these ideas and do so with some assumptions that we're okay with seeing the spaceship move at a certain speed and do a certain, you know what I mean? Like you can put all that in the back of your head and say, well, no, the technology's covered. I don't have to sit and nitpick this. We're good because science fiction is accepting the state of whatever tech is being shown to me. And tech and magic are often interchanged. And we can park our brain and then get to the nitty gritty of, okay, now in that scenario, how do these people or these aliens behave with each other? And sandbox is a great way to put that. Like it really is that, and maybe the strongest version of that in cinema. Cause what else gets close to that? Yeah. Like fantasy maybe,
but, yeah, but fantasy, right. You go in with the expectation, well, none of this could happen because it's all fantasy or none of this. It has any grounds in reality. Yeah.
Right. There are no dragons. There are no, but
sci-fi
wizards.
Has 1 foot planted in humanity and 1 foot planted in the future, 1 foot planted in what could be, and then
in
one foot planted
foot
what
planted
is.
In poop.
Yep.
There's and a third. All of a sudden I've got 7 feet.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I was going to say, but that's, see, we accept it because of science fiction, all those feet. It's fine.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I have a fun little question for you.
Yeah.
Again, I'm just looking at a list of the top 100 best sci-fi movies of all time. So that's a little subjective, but I like these top 100s because at least the top 50 is going to be pretty good, like pretty fairly close to what you would get if you asked anybody.
Fairly agreed upon. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in a top 100, there's like 65 different directors right?
Yeah.
And one of them stands out, really stands out among all of them as having the most top 100 sci-fi films of all time. And I'm wondering if any of you can just guess who that is.
I mean, Star Wars seems too obvious.
Steven Spielberg is the answer.
Oh.
And
sorry if you wanted to make that go on a little bit.
That's why, because I think because my real question is, what's your favorite Spielberg sci-fi?
Well, for Brian Dunaway, I already know the answer. AI. It's a little bit, it's a little movie called Minority Report. He's super into it. And
He started in AI and finished it up in Minority Report. Screwed the whole thing up.
Listen, I think AI is underappreciated. I think it's worth seeing and think it's
I don't think it's underappreciated at all. I think it's right where it should be.
I think it's
appreciated.
I think it's I appreciate it. There you go.
Yeah. No, I didn't say appreciated. I think it's appreciated.
I don't think that's a word, but okay. It's science whelming. Fiction.
It's totally whelming.
As far as like impact of science fiction, we probably consider Jurassic Park science fiction, right?
Yeah, E.T. is going to be my pick just because of the impact that it made on me
as
a kid. And I look back at that and I'm like, I still can't find flaws with it. It's hopeful, but it's still, there's a lot of danger. There's kind of that, it's not really technology going wrong, but it is man's arrogance in thinking that, well, anything that comes to this planet, we can rip apart and figure out how it works, kind of thing.
Right.
And see, my idea of hopefulness is my favorite Spielberg sci-fi film, which is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, because it doesn't go to that point that you're talking about, right? It ends with first contact. And it allows you, if you want to be hopeful, you go
where
right
are all
ahead.
Those humans going with those tiny aliens?
Right.
Very concerning.
It's just a fantastic film. Like, it's such a fine made
such
film.
A wildly paced movie. I love how it's paced. It's so, when I was young, I hated it. I'm like, oh my God, get on with it. But as I've gotten older, I'm like, God, I really love
kind
it.
Of, yeah. As a kid, you're like, when are the spaceships coming? When are we getting some aliens? It's like,
when's
oh,
when's it going to stop?
Shapes out of his
stop?
Yeah.
When we mashed potatoes.
It's not a good
kid film.
Yeah, the kids were not in mind for that, I don't think, which is fine because as an adult, I really appreciate it. But for me, it's Jurassic Park, and I probably would change this. I wouldn't have said this as a kid. As a kid, I would have been freaked out by Jurassic Park. I think it would have scared me more as more horror elements. But Jurassic Park is, I think, has its foot squarely in science fiction. And it innovates on every level, storytelling, the technical levels of things. I think the direction is insane. The pacing is one of the best paced films ever made. Right. That one really, the older I get, the more I lovingly look at Jurassic Park and think that that was a hell of a thing.
And it's another good example of this thing could, at least for the first two movies, before the dinosaurs get out and start making it to America, you know, to the mainland, and then we start hearing about newspapers and news reports and things like that. But it's like one of those little pocket sandboxes. Mm. Oh, okay, you know, scientist figures out a way to do this. He does it. A few select people come there. Most of them get eaten, but this is, you know, this all is happening completely outside of the rest of the world being aware of it.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of fun, like, this could be happening right now. We wouldn't know until a pterodactyl starts flying over the Empire State, the Empire State Building or something.
Do you ever remind yourself and then think about how weird it is that we just forget that Ready Player One was a Spielberg movie?
I forget that all the time. Very much.
I don't hate the movie. I kind of really enjoyed it, but it doesn't feel you needed the number one director in the history of modern cinema to do it.
I didn't have a Spielberg feel to that movie at all. I'm with you. Not feel Spielberg.
Really weird.
The book felt Spielbergian, which is funny, right? You know, Klein's writing felt, and obviously he was inspired by those movies.
By those movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why Spielberg had trouble with it. Maybe. I don't know.
I mean, maybe. I think that's why he was drawn to it. I think he was like, wow, this mega hot book. Plus, I had tons of Spielberg references. I mean, not that that's what sways the man, but I think he once in a while just gets like, I just made something super serious. Even Jurassic Park and Schindler's List come out the same damned year. Like, what is that about?
I know I complain about Minority Report and AI because I felt like Spielberg matured out of or changed from what I loved. I loved all the stuff before then, and it's hit or miss after that. But I also respect the fact that he never stopped growing. He's continued to try new things, different things. Well, also, this hasn't worked for me personally.
Don't forget AI was half Kubrick. That's the thing people forget.
That's what I said. I've always said Kubrick's the one who screwed it up. That's where it started falling apart. He started hanging out with Kubrick, who's a weirdo, and he freaking screwed it all up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then he said, I'm going to put a little bit of The Shining into Ready Player One. So good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Kubrick.
Let me ask you one more quick question while we're talking like this. What is your favorite animated sci-fi movie of all time?
Oh, shit. Well, you said it already. Iron Giant's my favorite.
I know you already said it. It's hard to argue with that.
Iron Giant's so good. It's so repeatably watchable. I just freaking love it. But I like Titan A.E. I like...
that's a really good... I haven't seen that in forever.
That's underappreciated. I think it was also... kids were a little put off by it because it's, again, it's not really kid... It's kid-friendly, but I just mean the story's a little more mature, I think.
I think, again, saying that I feel like sci-fi or superhero movies are, by and large, sci-fi movies, and I'd say Into the Spider-Verse.
Oh, shit. Man, of course.
That is very science fiction-y. There's literally a multiverse. Oh,
there's a multiverse. Yeah,
exactly. That's a very good one. And that, I mean, that thing shot up my list. This new one is, I love it so much. Yeah. I can barely stand myself.
A phenomenal movie.
Do we, like, if you look at... Raiders of the Lost Ark, adventure films or science fiction films? What are those?
I say adventure more.
Because they do a lot of shit in there that's like, you know, I don't mean just Crystal Skull, which is, you know, alien.
Oh, yeah. Now that's science fiction.
Well, the ride is in Adventureland and not in Fantasyland. So,
ding. It's not in Tomorrowland.
I just want to mention my favorite animated sci-fi movie, which is WALL-E. It depends on science fiction, the genre. Like it there's nothing about it that really fits any other genre, but it's so heartwarming, you know?
No, the first third of that movie is one of my favorite first thirds of any movie. Yeah, and I love the whole thing, but when they get to the ship, it's a lot more like traditional. But the first part of it is so...
When it's just Wally alone, cleaning up the planet. And
Videos of what's his name, who died recently. I can think of his name, the comedian. He would. It's the first time they put live action people into a Pixar film.
Right.
The guy from Best in Show. He's like, well, I can't think of the guy's name. Fred Willard.
Yep.
It's an odd thing they did with that, but yeah.
Yeah.
Another one I always think is underappreciated, but also made shit tons of money. And I really liked it. I don't know what everybody else's problem is, but I thought his version of War of the Worlds was great. And that is as science fiction as you get, man. That's classic science fiction.
Yeah.
And I loved it. I thought that was great. Freaking Tim Robbins, Dakota Fanning, Thomas Cruise. You may have heard of Thomas Cruise.
Oh, did he do his own stuff?
He did his own stunts whilst fighting giant.
Did he jump off like a crane or something like that?
I don't know.
Climb up the side of a spaceship with suction cups.
Yeah, but they're, you know, it is easy though to. I think it's fair to look at Spielberg's catalog and say you are a massive influence on science fiction for the last 50 years.
I think that's
I don't know how you get away from that. Like, I can't without, you know, there are some major impacts from others, but they're singular. It's like, you know, James Cameron definitely fits in that category. I'd call him just slightly less, but he's there.
Yeah.
And I would obviously, George Lucas belongs there, even though it's a single project, you know, huge. I mean,
it's spread so wide.
Well, and we haven't even brought up Star Wars. So to finish things out today, let's just touch on that. Sure. Is Star Wars, Star Wars is basically Lord of the Rings with laser swords and blasters.
Right.
It really is.
More fantasy, touches on elements of spirituality.
Yeah. It's less about science, right? It's more about
it's a family drama. Everybody's related.
It's a family drama. It's a soap opera. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say this is one of those tricky ones because there is so much sci-fi and it has so much of its foundation firmly set in science fiction, but the Force stuff is purely fantasy. It's supernatural, right. And that's the kind of the one of the hallmarks of fantasy is the unexplainable, at least until you get to midichlorians, which we won't even bring up, but you know, that it's still that aspect of it is the fantasy aspect of it. So like 60-40,
it's like the Apple split. Maybe it's 70-30, you know. That's how much money you're going to get for your app on the App Store. You're going to get 70-30.
It would definitely have went in the sci-fi section at Blockbuster, though. Definitely would.
Oh, yeah, of course. Because you had laser guns and laser swords and you had ships and space. And that's all it really takes. But that Star Wars it's like one of the great, you know, that quote, one of the greatest tricks the devil ever played was convincing you it was whatever. It's like that. It's that movie convinced you it was a science fiction movie. But really, it isn't. It's just none of it's based in science. Like, they're not going, yes, the blaster is a derivative. You know, they don't get into that. It's just
we do have a lot of sci-fi nerds who go that direction with Star Wars stuff, and it's fun. That's fun. That's fine.
Oh, of course. Go deep as you want to go.
It's kind of like this. Name one, I don't know if it really applies or anything, but name one technology in Star Wars that made it over into our universe. We'd Star Trek all the time. It's like we're constantly trying to make shit that was on Star Trek.
Well, Star Wars stuff. That's a good example. That's a great question because I have an answer to that. And it will help define what I'm saying that Star Wars is defined differently. And that is that everybody wants to make shit that's in Star Wars, but it's not practical. Like, you've seen these guys on YouTube who've figured out finally how to make a lightsaber that's about six feet long or whatever, that stops at a certain point, but it's hooked up to all kinds of weird cables and fuel and all this stuff because it won't work otherwise. So there's this feeling of like, man, to recreate that fantasy, I have made a sort of working lightsaber, a whole other kind of aiming for, you know, trying to duplicate what a movie would give you, whereas Star Trek's like,
kind of already existed in our world by the time Star Wars came along. So that's kind of like UTEC
prosthetic hands and things like that. What about like BB
robots?
Robots that serve you are my answer to your question.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
I'm not saying Star Wars innovated that, but it is definitely a big pillar.
No, that was Battlestar Galactica. Don't get mad.
No, that was
right. But things like gyroscopic robots, like BB-8, the fact that Sphero came along and said, we could actually make that, and we made that, and we put it in the movie and that sort of thing. Like the fact that that now I've got a little BB-8 that can sit and patrol my dining room. Yeah.
Right. I wonder why iRobot and others haven't done the spherical thing for actual, like, you know, for Roombas or this robot that Amazon sells. I forget what it's called, Rob or something. It'll go around the house and respond.
That's Nintendo. It's not Nintendo Rob, isn't what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I can't remember the name of the damn thing, but it will go around the house. You can call for it. It'll come to you. Yeah. You can have it do things. Like, we are getting closer to what a droid is in Star. So, yeah, perfect one, actually. That's probably the only one where it's like real life has mirrored that a little bit. Not quite. You know, he's not helping us fly our ships or hacking into some giant prison planet or anything.
I just want a Tweaky. I mean, if I could just have if I could just have a Flava Flav wearing Tweaky, that'd just be that'd be great.
I forgot he had that shit around his neck. Oh my gosh, yeah, dude!
Which robot would you like to have? You could have any sci-fi robot.
I just told you Tweaky's was great. He's fantastic. Well,
okay, we got your answer. I was going to ask the other.
Sorry, my bad. Sorry.
No, I think I'm going back to the Iron Giant because I want to do that. Not only like. Fly me around, but
we can do like some digging around the yard and, you know, something big and useful.
But sure. The first thing that popped into my head when you said that a bit was, for some reason, I want a K2SO because I like his attitude. Yeah. I want a robot that I can relate to. Hold on, I'm saying.
Right. K2SO, help me. Who is that?
Rogue One.
Oh, shit. Yeah, okay.
Alan Tudyk.
Alan Tudyk. Voice. Okay.
Robot. He's just a little bit depressed.
Is it Tudyk or is it Tudyk or Tudyk? I want to get that. Is it?
I don't care.
I don't care.
Does he have two dicks or two dykes? What is it? Which is?
Doesn't matter. Both.
That's two very different things, right? Like.
But also, I like K2SO because you never know when you're gonna need someone to like blow up a tree that's in your path, and he'll just do it. He'll just make it disappear.
Guess what? Iron Giant. Toothpicks, that thing is there.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But imagine the upkeep. Like,
that upkeep's a lot, man.
That's a lot. Yeah. But, well, there you go.
Was that your answer? Was Iron Giant your answer?
Iron Giant.
Iron Giant is my answer, yeah. Right.
Hell yeah.
Final answer?
Well, there you have it. I know what I don't want.
Count from Blade Runner 2049 because I might change it.
I want that. I want that weird, blocky looking thing from Interstellar. That annoying.
Okay.
Jeez.
That thing is so impractical. I didn't know
we could pick Monolith from like 2000.
That's what I'm saying. It's like it's just nothing but a slab with barely opposable slab arms.
The robot astronauts in Interstellar are truly spectacular. Like I find myself just like daydreaming about those those robot astronauts.
I love them because they're impractical, but also so unusual for a design. Like.
That movie's
you're making me want to watch that damn movie right now.
Dude, watch Interstellar. Yeah, like you should watch Interstellar regularly. Like the most recent time I watched it, I picked up on so many things that I hadn't really noticed before.
Well, there's no shortage of places to see that. Prime, MGM Plus, Paramount Plus, FX Now. All these services, they all have it. So
Interstellar is actually going back to the list of the top 100. Interstellar is the most controversial when you talk to people about their greatest of all time. Like you will have people put Interstellar in the top 10 and you will have people put Interstellar outside of the top 100. Like there's no like real in between.
Well, putting it out of the list are wrong. It's a great movie and people should see it. You want to see, you want to see Matthew McConaughey cry real hard? Boy, howdy, do I have a movie for you. All right. Well, that is going to do it for our special covering the science fiction genre. We hope you guys enjoyed it. I know we did. And we'd love to hear your favorites, your things and stuff maybe you're looking forward to. Is there anything this year that you're all like, oh, I'm jonesing for that? Or, this year or next year in the sci-fi genre world?
I just want to say anything from Star Trek or Star Wars at this point right now. And if you took me back a year, I would have said I'm done with Star Wars for now. Mm-hmm. And then boom, Andor. And I'm like, wow. Okay. I guess we're not done with Star Wars.
Yeah. I can't wait for us to watch 65. That's what I'm waiting for. It's on Netflix now. I don't understand why we haven't watched it yet.
It's going to be this summer. It's going to be part of our hands.
I just can't imagine
I'm excited for Marvel's.
Marvel's
superhero sci-fi space.
Yeah, there you go. No, it totally fits. Marvel's totally
not fit. The new Transformers. Yeah. Okay,
Right. Well, that's
no, already, not no. definitely not the new Transformers.
I'm looking forward to seeing that, but it, you know, it's not high on my list.
I'm looking forward to watching it for free when it comes onto a streaming service that I pay for.
For me, the obvious and simple the obvious and simple answer is Dune Part 2. I don't know what the heck's wrong with the rest of you. Yeah. So that is going to be amazing. I can't wait for that coming out this October or no November. No,
what, this October.
October.
Oh, it was next,
October.
Next year.
It's
this year.
No, it's this year. Year. It's this year. Okay, but it's October.
Dune Part 2. Although there has been some just this week, there's been some rumors that it's going to get bumped back a few months.
I thought it got bumped
because of the writers and actors strike.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I thought they were done, like in the can on that thing.
Right, but there may be some people in solidarity with the strike who are trying to bump it back so that they can have actors like doing marketing.
Oh, I see. Personally, you know, holding my, you know, torturing me personally is the way they're going to do this. I see. Well, anyway, that is our show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Please check out filmsack.com for everything else. We'll be back next time with a whole other thing, another movie. I don't know what it is yet.
We have a movie next week. Yeah, you'll see it on our sites.
Yeah, sign up or get into our Discord. There's no signing up. Just get over on our Discord. We always have a little thread going about the film of the week and that sort of stuff. If you want to hang out with more film sackers, it's a great bunch of discussion going on all the time. So join us at frogpants.com/filmsack. Super easy. Support us at Patreon at patreon.com/filmsack. That'll do it for us, for me, for Brian, and for Randy.
And Gage.
See you next time.
Get more at frogpants.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.